Welcome to Micro College. My name is Jacob Hunt. I'm the director of Thoreau College, the micro college located in rural southwestern Wisconsin in the beautiful Driftless region. We offer gap semester programs and short courses for young adults 18 into their 20s. Right now, we're accepting applications for our fall semester and our spring semester of 2025. And we also offer classes for adults, homesteading skills, folk arts through the Driftless Folk School. Today on Micro College, we are really excited to have as our guest Dr. Dan McCannon. He serves as the Ralph Waldo Emerson Unitarian Universalist Senior Lecturer at Harvard Divinity School, where he has taught since 2008. He studies religious and spiritual movements for social transformation in the United States and beyond, with particular emphasis on environmental activism, intentional communities, and socialism. Much of his research focuses on the Unitarian Universalist tradition and the Anthroposophical movement. He's the author of six books, among them Camp Hill in the Future, Spirituality and Disability in an Evolving Communal Movement, Eco-Alchemy, Anthroposophy and the History and the Future of Environmentalism, and Prophetic Encounters, Religion and the American Radical Tradition, which won the Frederick G. Melker Book Award. Earlier works explored the Catholic worker movement and nonviolent activism in the early 19th century. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dan.
Thank you so much, Jacob. It's great to be part of this conversation and great to connect more fully with the work of Thoreau College.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. On the podcast here, I always begin by asking people about their early lives, and especially people who are working with young adults as you are there at Harvard. Maybe could you reflect for us back when you were 18, 19, 20 years old? Where were you? What were you doing? What were the big influences on your life during that period?
Yeah, so that's it's a fascinating question. I'm old enough that I don't spend every day thinking about what I was doing at 18 or 20. But I was an undergraduate student at Harvard College, the same place where I teach now. I was I think I was drawn to Harvard after attending a fairly middle-of-the-road high school because I wanted to be surrounded by others who were deeply committed to the intellectual life. And for the time I was there, that worked out really well. I think by the time I was finished, I was much more interested in learning and living in environments where people were a bit more diverse in their ages, their life experiences, and so forth. So that was, something I was wrestling with at the time. Do I want to be in a very intense and somewhat homogeneous learning environment, or do I want to be exposed to a wider range of perspectives? Two of the things that really helped me, I suppose, at the time were, number one, I took a lot of classes at Harvard Divinity School, which then, a bit more than now, but still now to some degree, enrolled people of lots of different ages. So I did have the opportunity to learn alongside people in their 40s and 50s, as well as other 20-year-olds. That's an opportunity that many 20-year-olds in colleges don't get to have. And the other thing was that I was one of the student directors of the Harvard Square homeless shelter, which meant that I spent 2 or 3 evenings a week spending my time with people whose life experiences were very different from those of my classmates, people who had fallen on hard times economically, had been traumatized by their experiences in war, or had struggles with mental illness or with addiction that left them without a place to live and relying on the support of my classmates and I, who were running this small shelter for about 25 people each night. I guess the other thing I would say, I was deeply religious at the time. At the time, I was especially devoted to the religious philosophy of Soren Kierkegaard, who put a strong emphasis on finding an individual path in life. My own individual path led me to some spiritualities quite different from those of Kierkegaard, including both Unitarian Universalism and Anthroposophy. I suppose the core Kierkegaardian idea that one does need to struggle to find one's unique calling has stayed with me.
What stands out from your body of work and your research is this intersection between religious and spiritual movements and action in the world, right? Whether that's the Catholic worker movement or, nonviolent movements, and you can say that goes back to, Emerson and Thoreau back there in the Transcendentalist movement, but also the Anthroposophical movement, biodynamics, the Camp Hill movements. And I'm wondering about, that stands out from your biography, and it sounds like that has deep roots, right? How did you how did that form, where did that come from in your life?
I suppose so. I suppose in some ways I have a kind of classic left-wing personality. I care a lot about fairness. I care a lot about compassion. And I tend to think that fairness and compassion trump other values. So I think that shapes a lot of my sensibilities. I think it's also true that I've always been very interested in spiritual questions, in the ways immaterial realities interweave with the physical world. And I've also always had, a strong current of skepticism. I can be very interested in lots of spiritual traditions and not come away entirely certain of what I myself believe to be ultimately true. And as at a practical level, that's caused me to be more comfortable in life situations where I have accountability in multiple directions. So, for example, a lot of professors feel that their sole professional accountability is to the academy. I suppose maybe to some combination of their scholarship and their students. But the academy provides the primary frame of reference, the primary way of assessing value for their work. And I've always been more comfortable in situations where I'm simultaneously accountable to the academy, to religious communities, currently in my own life, Unitarian Universalism, and to movements for social transformation, which has certainly included for me a lot of intentional community movements, such as the Camp Hill movement.
I think the relationship between progressive or left-wing kind of political movements and religious and spiritual movements is complex, right? I think many people might not think of it first of all when they think about an anti-war movement or social justice movement of some kind. But if you look, I think your work really points out what a deep and history that has. And what if people aren't thinking about the spiritual roots of various political movements on the left, what are they missing, and what is that kind of the unseen realities bring into those discourses?
Religious and spiritual traditions have been a part of every leftist or radical social movement in the United States and around the world, just as they've been a part of every right-wing social movement. There are some movements where the religious dimension is really obvious. When people think about the Southern freedom struggle of the 1950s and 1960s, also known as the Civil Rights Movement, they think first about the role of prominent ministers such as Martin Luther King Jr. as organizers of that. When people think about the abolition of slavery in the 19th century in the United States, they often think about religious leaders. When people think about the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, they'll quickly think about the role of somebody like Desmond Tutu. When people think about socialism or second wave feminism, they may not immediately think of religious dimensions of those movements, but there were, oh boy, there were so many ordained ministers running for office on the Socialist Party ticket in the 19 teens and 1920s in the United States. Probably there's no other political parties ever had such a high share of clergymen running for office. So there's a dimension all the way around. And the way I like to think about this is the religion is an important part of every radical movement. Number one, because religious communities are the places where people are organized in large groups. Like there's no other kind of organization that as many people belong to as religious communities. So when somebody like Martin Luther King is able to galvanize the organized energies of local congregations, that can be really powerful. So that's one point of connection. Another point of connection is that radical movements work a lot the same way as spiritual or religious movements, which is to say, they hold out on to people a set of transcendent ideals, if you will. The idea of a society in which people, so the idea of a society organized on the principle of from each according to their ability to each according to their need is not something that we experience on a daily basis, most of us. I don't even think in the Soviet Union, people experience that on a daily basis. But it's something that can inspire a lifetime of devotion in much the same way that the example of somebody like Jesus of Nazareth on breaking bread with a few followers and suddenly hundreds are being fed can inspire this kind of deep devotion. And this means, on the one hand, that when religion and the radical movement work together, they're super powerful. And on the other hand, sooner or later, there's going to be a blow up because some people will say this radical movement is the true religion. We no longer need the church or the synagogue or the mosque, whatever it was, as it existed before. And so in my research on this, I try to say there's a religion dimension to every radical story. But it's not always neat and tidy. It often involves real conflict, as people come to very different conclusions with one another, and even over the course of a single lifetime, most radicals have related to religion in very different ways at different points along their journey.
So the community you mentioned at the beginning of that response is another important theme that works together through your work and through the movements that you document. And I think I know that an important part of your story also involves the Camp Hill movement and your most recent some of your most recent work as well. And I would say in my life, the places where I've seen people living out the gospel, let's say. Right. And it's in the most, this kind of true kind of spirit of Christianity. I think the Camp Hill communities that I visited are way up there. Really powerful examples of life sharing communities, people really living lives of service. So I'm wondering if you could just describe a little bit. Camp Hills have been mentioned on this podcast a few times, but not really explained. So just on a very basic level, what is the Camp Hill movement? What is your engagement with the Camp Hill community? And yeah, and how is this an expression of the sort of things you were just talking about?
So Camp Hill is a network of about 120 intentional communities worldwide. And when I say intentional community, I mean a group of people. It could be a dozen, could be several hundred or thousands who live and work together with some level of economic cooperation, although the exact structure for that varies from intentional community to intentional community, and some sense of common purpose. In the case of Camp Hill, each Camp Hill community brings together people with and without intellectual disabilities to share daily life. Meaningful work, often agricultural or craft work, a cycle of seasonal rituals and weekly spiritual practice, and a vision of not only creating an inclusive society within the bounds of the Camp Hill place, but a vision of being a seed of social renewal for the larger society. And since we're talking about micro colleges and gap year programs, one of the most important ways in which Camp Hill lives out its vision of social renewal is by welcoming young people for a gap year experience of intentional community. So in the typical Camp Hill place, you would have a group of adults or teenagers or children with intellectual disabilities who are part of the community as a way of education if they're younger, or finding meaningful work if they're older. There are a group of people who, so-called non-disabled people, who have made a lifelong or a long-term commitment to sharing life with folks with disabilities. You have a group of employees who are earning a paycheck to participate in different aspects of the Camp Hill place. And then you have these so-called young coworkers, the gap year folks, who come to Camp Hill perhaps because they're interested in a career involved in some way with issues of disability, perhaps because they're interested in a career involved in some way with environmental sustainability and are attracted to the agricultural work that happens in most but not all Camp Hill places. But more typically, these young coworkers come because they want to experience life in a different culture, because Camp Hill is in many different parts of the world. It's a kind of streamlined way to find yourself in a different place, maybe to learn a new language or to enhance one's ability in a language that's not one's first language, and to discover themselves. And one of the things that these young coworkers often discover is that an intentional community with people of all ages and abilities, and an intentional community that makes you responsible for concrete tasks that other people are relying upon, can be a really logical first step out into the world after you leave your family home. That in some ways, this is a better way of moving into adulthood than a conventional college experience where you are simply doing what you've been doing for the past 12 years of spending most of your time in a classroom, reading the books and writing the papers and doing the experiments that a teacher tells you to do.
Yeah, that's I've had multiple students, both from my high school teaching days and here from Thoreau College, for whom this is exactly, it was a perfect next step. And they are, I encourage anyone listening to this who is thinking about a gap year to definitely check out the Camp Hill movement. And it's global. Many of the volunteers or the young co-workers at the Camp Hills in the United States are Germans who are on doing their alternative service, but there's also opportunities throughout Europe and elsewhere in the world that for Americans and also indeed anywhere in the US. So it's a really it's a powerful way, as you say, to land as your next step and really to do to be engaged with some really high service and yeah, concrete kind of ways of impacting and collaborating with other people. Yeah, and I think so you've, I know, have spent some time at particular Camp Hills. Can you talk a little bit about your own experience?
Yeah, well, I'll jump back to your initial question about what I was doing at age 20. And at age 20, I had a 22-year-old friend, Kathy, who had graduated 2 years ahead of me from Harvard College and went off and was part of an organization called the Lutheran Volunteer Corps. I was a Lutheran at the time. And the Lutheran Volunteer Corps, much like the Jesuit Volunteer Corps and any number of similar programs sponsored by different religious groups, is, typically a gap year program, a post-college gap year program, where 22-year-olds, but also people of all ages, spend a year working for a social justice or social service organization. And living in a small household scale, intentional community with other volunteers. So Kathy's experience inspired me to join the Lutheran Volunteer Corps when I was 22. And I had an interesting year. I was living in an intentional community, but it was a very small intentional community. For most of the year, there were two of us in my household. And that left me with a lifelong hunger for intentional community on a somewhat larger scale. But also, I suppose, a lifelong lack of confidence that intentional community can truly work. So I've always made it a practice to sort of look out for the intentional communities in my neighborhood ever since that LVC experience. As a doctoral student in Chicago, I was a regular volunteer at a Catholic worker house on the south side of Chicago. I made lunch every day for about 30 hungry people. Or not every day, every week, once a week.
Which Catholic worker house was that?
It's not the most famous Catholic worker house in Chicago. And now I'm embarrassed to say that I'm not 100% confident I even remember the name. I think it was called Catherine of Genoa. It was a community that had started as an AIDS hospice, as a hospice place for people with HIV who were in their final years. And when I encountered them, which would have been in 1993 or 1994, it was a very funny moment for AIDS hospice programs because treatments had just begun to reach the point where people who thought that AIDS was a death sentence were discovering that it wasn't. And so this Catholic worker house doing hospice for people who did not wind up dying was then in a place of kind of reinvention and rediscovery. I was a fairly incidental to that because what I was doing was the more kind of classic Catholic worker soup kitchen function. I went to the kitchen. I got a log of government surplus ground beef or ground pork that was like a foot and a half long, 6 inches wide. I was a vegetarian. But I had to somehow turn this log of meat and, paint can-sized cans of beets or tomatoes or carrots or whatever it had happened to be. I turned all that into soup for just people in the neighborhood who were hungry. So that was my first experience with a Catholic worker. And also as a grad student, I visited one of the historic communal sites that dot the American landscape, the Icaria community in Nauvoo, Illinois. And I picked up when I was there a directory produced by a great organization then called the Fellowship for Intentional Community, now called the Foundation for Intentional Community, but it's the largest, most inclusive network of intentional communities in the United States. And back then, their directory was in print, so I picked up this thick volume. And when I got my first teaching job at the St. John's University and the College of St. Benedict in Minnesota, I took out my handy FIC Intentional Communities directory and said, "Who's in my neighborhood?" Well, immediately in my neighborhood were the two monastic communities that sponsored my college. But only a little bit further away was Camp Hill Village, Minnesota. As it happened, it was basically the midpoint between the college where I was teaching and the very small town in Minnesota where my mother had grown up and where her brothers still ran my grandfather's blacksmith shop. So I called them up and said, "Hey, can I come spend some time with you?" Initially, I just thought this would be a good way to spend part of my summer each year. It was very fun to be with those German young coworkers, encountering the same Minnesota landscape where my German ancestors had arrived 100 years before. I got the idea I could take my students to visit. Began a practice of doing field trips to Camp Hill that I am able to continue in New England now. And also realized I was pretty curious about Camp Hill life. One of the things I didn't mention, I should have mentioned when I was introducing Camp Hill before, is that it's inspired by the spiritual work of Rudolf Steiner, the tradition of anthroposophy, and tries to bring together many of the different dimensions of anthroposophical spirituality into its life rhythms. I got very curious about the environmental dimension of anthroposophy, curious about why people who were reading books with titles like How to Know Higher Worlds were also so committed to sustaining healthy life forms in this material world. My book, Eco-Alchemy, is an attempt to explain how those two things fit together. But yeah, from those beginnings with Camp Hill Village, Minnesota, I've been able to visit about 50 of the 120 Camp Hill places worldwide and talk to a lot of Camp Hillers about their lives and the way their movement has evolved over many generations of history.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So this, as you pointed out, a micro college is certainly as we've conceived it here at Thoreau, and it's kind of has started to be articulated through this podcast and through some of the growing gatherings of people working on this idea. Really, the idea of a life sharing community, an intentional community, is somewhere deep down in its roots. And scale, of course, is important, right? The scale where people can live intimately, usually a few more than two, but not many more. Right. And also to engage with the land and to engage with service in some form, and indeed with some form of exploration of meaning, whether you call that religion or spirituality or at least just ceremony or ritual in the cycle of the seasons here. So I'm wondering, I mean, you now are you're a teacher, you're there in one of the great universities of the world. I'm wondering about how some of these experiences and these interests translate into your work as a teacher. You mentioned bringing students off on field trips to places, but also in your classrooms and in the campus life there. What are the harmonies and what are maybe some of the disharmonies of that those interests and that experience where you are now?
Yeah, so a lot of the harmonies kind of flow from the unique identity of Harvard Divinity School for a variety of reasons. Our Divinity School has come to understand itself as a fully multi-religious community of learning for the sake of learning and also learning for the sake of leadership in spiritual and religious communities. So people from all the major religions of the world and a great many small and rapidly evolving spiritual traditions come together and to study. Some of them are planning to have careers as academic scholars of religion. Some of them are planning to have careers in conventional or unconventional forms of ministry in Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu, et cetera, contexts. And some are hoping to bring a deep understanding of religion and spirituality into other areas of life work, such as journalism or activism or public service, politics, the arts, et cetera. So we have this very rich mix of students, which makes it quite easy for me to share on my own explorations of intentional community, my own explorations of anthroposophical spirituality. So I do a course called Alternative Spiritualities in the United States. That's one of the courses where we're able to go and visit Canto places. I do another course called Religion and Ecology. And likewise, we would visit a Canto place. And in the one case, with a little more emphasis on the spiritual dimension, another case, more emphasis on the environmental dimension. But in both cases, really seeing how those fit together along with this very strong theme of inclusion of people of all abilities and disabilities. So those are the harmonies. The disharmonies flow, I suppose, from the fact that Harvard Divinity School is a part of Harvard University, which is a very old and very wealthy institution, with a particular set of traditions and practices, some of which don't fit very comfortably with the values that I've found so beautifully expressed in intentional community movements like Camp Hill or the Catholic Worker. One of the things that's really exciting about Camp Hill is that it is committed to the idea that society has an obligation to help every person find meaningful life work. Whether you can, whether you're really clever at taking tests or whether you're entirely nonverbal, whether you can, bench press 400 pounds or whether you use a wheelchair to get around, you have some gifts that other people and other creatures need, and you need some help in finding out how to actualize those gifts. And so Camp Hill does that, in a lot of Camp Hill places. It does it by creating communities of adults of different abilities where everybody has work that they can experience as benefiting the other people that they're living with. And some Camp Hill places actually specialize in providing a kind of coming of age experience for young adults with disabilities, where somebody, say, with Down syndrome or somebody with autism can have, you know, essentially a college experience, an experience where they leave home, they spend intense time with a new group of people, and they're really supported in finding the work that is right for them. And the fact that Campbell also does this gap year thing that provides a similar kind of experience for free to a lot of young adults is, you know, reinforces the same ethos that everybody needs a little help finding our path in life. And we as a society can commit to offering that. Now, you know, some people maybe need more help than others. When going back to, you know, what I was like when I was 20, you know, when I was 20, I was eager to be with other people who were really clever and bookish and to talk about big ideas. And honestly, I needed some help from society in finding my way to those other people. And Harvard did a good job of helping me with that. So thank you to Harvard for that. but once I found them, you know, I didn't really need that much more help. You know, if you had taken me and, you know, all of my Harvard classmates or 100 of my Harvard classmates and, you know, put us in a factory and told us, you know, you need to spend 5 hours a day making widgets and the rest of your time, you know, you can chat with one another about big ideas and we'll use the money we make selling the widgets to buy you food and a place to sleep, you know, probably that would have been fine. You know, the kind of education that I was hungry for, you know, was not an education that would have cost a lot of money necessarily. You know, some of the young people on in these youth guidance programs in Camp Hill, you know, need a lot more support to find their path in life. There are some young people who can have really intense emotions at times, and they need to be with somebody that they trust all the time, so that that person can help them, you know, bring their emotions back into regulation when something, you know, triggers a strong emotional reaction. So to provide this sort of college experience for somebody like that, you know, would cost a lot of money because you have to support the one-on-one helper that they need. And, you know, and many people would fall, you know, somewhat in between those extremes. So, you know, really, I just need a place to talk to people about big ideas, and I need one-on-one support. So I definitely would not say that society ought to invest the same number of resources into helping every young person come of age. But I do believe that society should invest should invest the right amount of resources in every young person, regardless of so-called ability or regardless of the kind of family that that young person comes from. Harvard University has a different philosophy, and it's not accidental that, you know, I have many very committed, thoughtful colleagues who are completely committed to the philosophy that I'm about to describe. But the philosophy is essentially that some people have so much to give to society, so many talents, so many skills, that there should be essentially no limit to what society invests in the future of those young people. You know, if spending $100,000 a year helping those very talented young people find their path in life is good, spending $200,000 a year on them is better. And if that means that there isn't enough to go around for other young people to find their path in life, that's just the price society has to pay for making sure that the most talented are able to achieve their full potential, because the benefit that that will then give back to the larger society is going to be so great. And yeah, and it's just a, you know, it's just a big difference from what I see at Camp Hill.
Yeah.
And you know, there are ways in which you know, I can see the logic. You know, I talked about how, you know, really clever young people don't really need much beyond being with one another to get the education they need. And the truth is, that's more true for those among us, you know, who are on a path to being religion professors or novelists. I spent a lot of time with future novelists as an undergraduate. I think it's probably true for people who are on a path to being journalists. You know, a lot of our nation's top journalists got their start at the Harvard Crimson. I mean, I guess they need a printing press and a few other things, but you know, honestly, the students at the Harvard Crimson are not getting that much help from their professors in becoming great journalists. They're mostly doing it on their own. But there are other you know, really talented young people who are going to be brain surgeons. And you know, the future brain surgeons of the world can't just have a reading group and read great books together and come out after 8 years as brain surgeons, right? You actually do need to invest a lot of resources into the training of future brain surgeons, and certainly of you know, brain surgeons do a lot of value. You know, the person who really finds the definitive cure for malaria and saves the lives of, you know, billions of people. You know, they probably also need, you know, well-equipped laboratories, lots of great mentors, things that cost real money. So there's, you know, there's definitely a value for that. But honestly, you know, among current Harvard undergraduates, those who will wind up as brain surgeons or as medical researchers are greatly outnumbered by those who will wind up as bankers. So at Harvard, we have this paradox of we invest an enormous amount of resources in the training of a very small number of people on the theory that they have enormous potential to benefit society. But we don't consistently steer them into professions that are socially beneficial. We actually steer them in many cases into professions that are socially parasitic. So this is a huge, you know, this is a huge ethical quandary. And a final ethical quandary is that when you look at the 18-year-olds who have really obvious talents, who you can look at this 18-year-old and say, "Oh, I think this could be the person, who finds, the cure for malaria." Oftentimes, they are people in whom society has already invested enormous resources, either because they come from wealthy families or because they were identified as academically talented at a very young age and tracked into either scholarship programs at private schools or the so-called urban exam schools, places like Boston Latin or Bronx Science, Stuyvesant, these kinds of schools. So elite, elite universities like Harvard, on this idealistic meritocratic theory, take people who are extremely privileged, by and large, with some exceptions, and channel them into places where they don't actually wind up using their real talents for the common good. And clearly, all of us in the higher education field, but especially those of us who find ourselves teaching at places like Harvard, have a real responsibility to find a better way.
Yeah. Wow, I have a lot to say, a lot of my thoughts that flow from that conversation. Really, I appreciate you articulating that from your unique perspective on it. I mean, some thoughts that come to mind is, I mean, I do think that, they're when we talk about, the future brain surgeons, the people who cure malaria, those sorts of, technical trainings or those the skills needed to do those things are like they're apples and oranges with, I think, in some ways, the liberal arts tradition or the kind of formative kind of quality, finding your vocation, figuring out who you are, that kind of the education that I think we are engaged with here. I think a person could come to a thorough college, for example, and go on to be a brain surgeon, even though we're not teaching any neuroscience or anything like that. It does seem that we see in the students who end up coming here and to these other micro college and gap year programs that I've been interviewing on the podcast, people who are on a path to the STEM fields or to indeed, to government or to some more, something that will require a more highly kind of certified kind of training. And indeed, we have people who come here in the midst of or even after achieving a bachelor's degree at an institution. I don't think we've had any Harvard students here yet, but we've had students from Stanford and from the the big research universities here in the Midwest, University of Minnesota and Wisconsin, who come here in the midst or after having a bachelor's degree. And they're seeking something that they're not finding in those places, right? They are, these are the questions of meaning and purpose and of, the kind of core ethical and philosophical and indeed spiritual kind of perspectives that are, they and in general, there are people who are not necessarily complaining about their education, but it's not complete, right? It is, this, and part of it is also this coming of age piece that you were talking about before. It's not just people with intellectual disabilities who need coming of age rituals in our society. It's really neglected by our society in general, including for those who might be intellectually gifted or who have some sense of they have a path that's clear laid out, in the institutions, but they're not met on that soul level that I think can be met in intimate, I think place-based, engaged with nature, engaged with other people, engaged with art and with great ideas. In a way that's I think has been embodied in many of the best liberal arts colleges, including many that are struggling right now across the Midwest and New England and elsewhere. But are they in an environment where education is so terribly expensive for many people, to seek that out as opposed to going in and being trained for something that will pay back your student loans is a major barrier to finding that. And so we find people looking for alternative ways, whether that's a living in a camp hill or some sort of traveling around or coming to a program like ours that feeds that deep kind of need that is not being met even by the best universities, no matter how much they spend on that education, right? That's a piece of it. And also I think that when I look from our perspective here, one of the things I'd like to ask you about is, I know you've written interestingly about bringing your Harvard students to rural places to visit the Camp Hills and biodynamic farms that you write about. And we're here in the rural Midwest, and we've had students from around the world and from the coast who come here. And this is a place where even in the very brightest students from these places aren't necessarily going to Harvard, or even thinking about it. I know, and that was not on my horizon when I was a kid growing up here, there, and it's just cultural. And so I think you see the ways that the elite universities, this very, very restricted model of elite education, it's very strongly reproducing the structures of cultural division and class structures in the society and regional structures that are some of the big issues that we're facing. So when we talk about a micro college movement, a big part of the inspiration and model is the Danish folk high school movement, which is a this is a this is this holistic, enriching education for young adults, which is for everybody, right? And is in Denmark is a country, for example, with the population less than Wisconsin, that has 80 schools, kind of like Thoreau College, these folk high schools, and some which different times in the last 100 and 150 years, there have been 20 or 25% of the population has done something like this. And then they go on to university, or they go to be a farmer, or they do whatever they're going to do. But that kind of a year or a semester or a period of inner development is actually seen by the society as essential as creating citizens and creating whole people who will make a thriving society. And demonstrably that has worked in Scandinavia. And is to have a handful of elite universities is quite a different thing. From that seems artificially restricted, this kind of rich whole education that one might have.
When you were talking about the paths of the young person who spends time at Thoreau College and then pursues, say, a STEM education at a more conventional university, it occurred to me that in some ways our small band of religion majors at Harvard when I was an undergraduate, we're a little bit like a micro college
Sure.
in the sense that our program was small enough that we had some of that kind of intensity and collaborativeness. And as it happens, among my cohort of religion majors, there are more doctors than there are religion professors. There are two of us who are religion professors. There are at least four, maybe five or six doctors. Their experience certainly was that the kind of holistic liberal arts education that we got as religion majors was relevant to their medical careers. There's another large chunk of school teachers. The soon to be head of the Boston Teachers Union was one of my cohort. But one of my classmates, what we don't have among us are bankers, as far as I can recall. One of my classmates, who is a doctor now, is a pediatrician and was on a panel at our reunion about the crisis in medicine because elite medical schools are channeling people and really forcing them because of the way medical school is financed into elite specializations. Even as a society, we have this desperate shortage of primary care physicians. primary care physicians for, the kinds of people we would like to see as primary care physicians are not necessarily the ones who are best at jumping through the particular hoops that we ask future doctors to jump through. Most universities have a cranky professor of biochemistry whose job it is to discourage people from becoming doctors. And I also think it's essentially impossible, it's virtually impossible to become a doctor in this country if you can't pass high school calculus. But the skills aren't, are relevant to some medical specialties for sure, but not necessarily relevant to the core work. And so it is really interesting to think about, what kind of role microcolleges could play, say, in fostering the values and the habits of mind that would be suitable for primary care physicians, physicians assistants, nurse practitioners, this whole set of really important social roles that we are actually currently steering talented people away from.
Yeah. These people need to have very high people skills, very strong powers of observation, right? And those are different than what are often tested on a test or a big group exam.
And I guess maybe here's I'm thinking out loud here. It's a sort of twofold challenge. That on the one hand, institutions like Harvard. So if you have young people who are clever at taking calculus and biochem tests, an institution like Harvard says to them, you don't really want to be a primary care physician. You'd probably like to be either a specialist, a medical specialist, or a banker.
Yeah.
And then for the young people who might actually be really good at, at talking to somebody in a way that elicits what's really ailing that person, and good at paying attention, to the physical phenomenon in front of them, the particular coloration of a wound or something. And people who are good at those things are told, well, if you aren't also good at the calculus and biochem tests, all of these kinds of professions are just closed off to you. So I guess my challenge to the micro college movement is, does the micro college movement have a solution to this problem?
I think just another thought. I mean, it's interesting that some of your colleagues are teachers, right? As you mentioned, I do think something similar is going on with teaching, sub-secondary and elementary school education. That, I think, and we certainly have been engaged with this. I think I did a master's at the University of Chicago social sciences program there, and then made a conscious decision to come home to my hometown and teach high school, right? And I had a lot of family and cultural support for that. I was coming back into a very familiar context, a very interesting school that allowed me to be creative here at the Waldorf inspired high school here in Viroqua. But I see many of the people who come into our fellowship and residency programs here at Thoreau College. So these are generally people with bachelor's degrees who are exploring what next. And this is, I think, a really also important part of our mission. These are people who are sometimes in or considering applying to academic graduate programs in the humanities or social sciences. And we often give them an experience to do some teaching. Right, in an interesting environment, either with the gap year students and or with high school students here, and they find it to be really rich. And I think we have this tremendous, like, oversupply, in a way you could say, oversupply of humanities PhDs and people in you know, who are seeking to find a job out there in the shrinking kind of field, in a way, and a terrible undersupply of people who are could who in high school and in elementary school education. And there seems to be an opportunity there, and I think part of it is what you just said. People go who are they're good at reading books and writing and telling stories, and like, and really they're steered away from teaching, whether at the post-secondary level or certainly lower levels of, you know, younger students, because that's not where, if you're smart and successful, that's not what you do, right? And that's a, there's a cultural message, and that is producing a distortion, you know, of, you know, these places where people are interacting with people, right? Whether that's a nurse or, you know, a primary care physician or a high school and elementary school teacher or a farmer. Right, interacting with the world in a direct way, the messages of are discouraging of that, of which, you know, we have terrible kind of shortages of people in those areas. So I do think that Thoreau College, you know, what we're doing here very much is helping to address that, because we some of the things that keep people from teaching in elementary or secondary school education is a bureaucratic environment of those institutions, and in a sense of not being valued. And we do experience, you know, people experience like a lot of gratitude for their work here, and it's a really positive experience. We've seen people go from Thoreau College into high school teaching for sure, and certainly into agriculture.
This might be a little bit of a tangent, but this conversation has suddenly got me thinking about one of the aspects of Rudolf Steiner's writings and teachings that I found most useful, which is the approach to research that he learned from the German poet and scientist Goethe, and that he referred to as Goethean science, which is a discipline of approaching phenomena in a truly open-ended way, trying not to pass judgments. Trying not to test hypotheses, but simply to sort of notice what's going on and how the many different dimensions of the phenomenon fit together. So it seems like at Thoreau College, you have created a kind of Goethean laboratory. On where you're in a position to notice a bunch of things that are going on in our society. You're in a position to notice that the number of people in our society who would like to be humanities professors vastly exceeds the number of jobs. There are for humanities professors. And you're in a position to notice that the most fertile land in the country is inhabited by fewer and fewer people, that even as it is used to produce more and more commodities that are often used for things other than food. And I'm like naming all these phenomena, and I'm sure you can hear the judgments that are in the back of my mind that cause me to name certain phenomena, not others. But maybe your challenge, right, is just to to really lean into the question of, what is going on here? People whose parents and grandparents and great grandparents worked this land now think the real life is someplace else. Or if they stay, they feel abandoned by the larger society. What is happening? And if we listen deeply to what's happening, will a different path sort of emerge organically from that listening?
Yeah, that's really beautifully put. I think I really is a great compliment to be described as a Goethean institution in that sense. And I think it's certainly not by accident. Obviously, we are referencing Steiner in our inspirations, an important part of what we do. But also, I would say one of the great American Goetheans, which is Henry David Thoreau, right? Whose model of observation and of engagement with the world is something that deeply informs what we're doing as well there. Also a real, a Harvard alum and a bit of a critic of Harvard as well.
Yes, I mean certainly yes, the sort of ambivalent son of Harvard would be something that would describe both Thoreau and myself for sure.
Wow, Dan. So it's been an hour here, and we could go on a lot longer, and I hope we do again sometime. But I want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat and for sharing your life story and these observations about higher education. I think there's a lot to work with there.
You're most welcome. It's really been a delight, and I'm so thrilled that you've chosen this path in your own life, and that you're finding others who want to make the road by walking it with you.
All right, thank you.